the other, which the intellect of man has put to itself from the beginning, without even now resting in any final solution. The intellect, indeed, can hardly give the final answer, for that must, in its very nature, lie beyond the data of the physical consciousness and memory, whether of the race or the individual. Yet these are the sole data which the intellect is in the habit of consulting with something like confidence. In this poverty of materials, in this incertitude, it wheels from one hypothesis to another and calls each in turn a conclusion. Moreover, the solution depends upon the nature, source, and object of the cosmic movement. And as we determine these, so we shall have to conclude about birth and life and death, the before and the hereafter.
Here Sri Aurobindo is continuing with this idea of the appearance of life through the processes of birth and death, or between the processes of birth and death. And he has introduced in the first paragraph this notion that there is a mystery to this. The mystery is hedged with a kind of intuition of the involvement of life in matter, saying that it seems that life is involved in matter and seeks only the proper conditions for its appearance. And then, under the lack of those proper conditions, it becomes latent again, it disappears back in matter. But also, it points to the fact that this appearance is specially marked by the sense of the spirit upsurging in a medium which is inimical to it, or the opposite of it, consciousness appearing in unconsciousness. A soul, some flame of soul, or an evident vibration of the spirit, which is making its appearance in a medium which is its opposite. So, he's talking about, in this paragraph, this particular intuition of persistence. And he introduces it from the very beginning. All the known circumstances and results of birth presuppose an unknown before, and there is a suggestion of universality, a will of persistence of life, an inconclusiveness in death, which would point to an unknown hereafter. So here, as this usual with Aurobindo, He draws our attention not to the obvious conclusions that our empirical understanding will give us, but a deeper kind of intuition from which to proceed to conclusions that are not necessarily sense-based. And so he starts off like that. And Sri Aurobindo's method is always to invite us to these kinds of intuitions that are not constrained by what in the previous chapter he has called the constitutional ignorance. It's very interesting, and I think it's worth noting this method of Sri Aurobindo, which Elsewhere, he has called the Vedantic method of knowledge. So, if there is a kind of an intuition in this direction, we are justified in questioning whether what meets the eye through the conclusions of physical material reality are all there is to it, or whether we are justified in finding some other basis of knowledge. So he's saying the intellect cannot give the answer. If the intellect is to give the answer, all it has to go on is the evidence of the senses. And that can't give it any confidence. And so we find that, you know, and then he has an ironic statement there. He says, in this poverty of materials and this incertitude, it wheels from one hypothesis to another and calls each in turn a conclusion. And that's a kind of an ironic statement. And it refers to some extent to the method of science, to what indeed has become, in a way, the dogma of the insistence on sense knowledge. You know, one would almost say, you see, to contrast the method of knowledge in this, just this paragraph, is very instructive, because everywhere, and this paragraph is an example, Sri Aurobindo will invite us to probe our intuition of some kind of existence outside of the knowledge of our senses. And he does this against the grain of what common sense will tell us, because so-called common sense, even the word common sense, is really the sense that is made in us or given or sort of accepted by us because it is commonly accepted. It is what the milieu or the suggestions of universal humanity in a time and place accept to be reality. And that common sense in our case today is conditioned by the history of science, by the fact that material reality is given a greater predominance and priority over any other kind of reality. So, to a paragraph like this present one, immediately the kind of alarm signals will go up as to why should we at all give any credence to these sort of irrational thoughts about persistence of life before and after their appearance in material form, if that is all that we can get out of our physical senses. Is it just a speculation that Sri Aurobindo is undertaking due to some irrational sort of bias of his own? Why should we trust in any other reality than what the senses give us? But if we probe this kind of thinking, we immediately find that that itself is a bias. The evidence of our senses, however much commonsensical they may seem to be, are definitely not a sound datum for coming to any conclusion about reality, leave alone about the persistence or non-persistence of life beyond the material sphere. So here, that's why he's poking a little fun at that particular kind of mentality which is so common to us. He says, in this poverty of materials and this incertitude, it wheels from one hypothesis to another and calls each in turn a conclusion. And then he points us in the direction of where to find the solution. The solution depends upon the nature, source, and object of the cosmic movement. And as we determine these, so shall we have to conclude about birth and life and death, the before and the hereafter. So this again, it's very interesting. He's drawing our attention to much larger realities than the empirical study of the human life between birth and death. See? If we study the cosmic movement and see man's, the meaning of man's life or the meaning of life itself within that cosmic movement, then we are justified in finding some kind of an answer which has greater possibility of truth, of validity, than a narrow focus on the life of humanity or on the life of individuals. The appearance of man on the stage of human concern as the object of attention and knowledge is a relatively short-lived thing. Man has appeared as an object of understanding based on study, empirical study, only from around the 17th or 18th century. Before that, man existed as a kind of form of consciousness hedged around by larger cosmic realities of which he was a part. So that total vision, the universality of things and of man's place in it, is what must return to us if we are to understand the meaning of human existence, its appearance and its disappearance.
Is the question regarding the intuition which presupposes the unknown before the birth. Can you explain that? I didn't understand what. How can you explain there is an unknown before the birth? What is the intuition for that?
He's talking, all the known circumstances and results of birth presuppose an unknown before. There is a suggestion of universality, etc., on the other side. So he's talking about the fact that human consciousness, when it appears, it doesn't appear with the sense of beginning. It already is burdened with a memory which is uncanny. We already have preformed kinds of responses. We have abilities to sort of jump into certain kinds of understandings. The child, sort of already shows a remarkable degree of the development of consciousness, which is not so easy to explain through the notion of something which comes for the first time into existence. We are burdened with the memory of our past, even though we may not have the natural apparatus, the developed prakriti, a prakritic instrument to express it. And that is why he's talking about this, intuition of something that has gone before, just making its appearance through birth.
Thank you.
Similarly, one can think about what he's calling the inconclusiveness in death, which points to an unknown hereafter. See, for one, the intrinsic human consciousness finds death alien to it. We see it all around us, but this is exactly that most profound question asked by the Yaksha to the Pandava brothers in that scene where they go thirsty looking for water. And the Yaksha of the lake asks, what is the most mysterious of things? And only Yudhishthir answers correctly, and the answer he gives is, the most mysterious thing is that all human beings die, but they conduct their lives as if they will never die. Now, this is a very profound observation. It's not a sort of a humorous observation. It is a profound psychic observation. It is an observation that comes from the fact that though our senses give us the evidence of this disappearance all around us, and we respond to it also through our emotional reactions as if it is a reality, still in our inner sense it is alien to us. That's why it never really means something very solid to our inner understanding, because we are immortal. We have come from a past beyond this life, and we are proceeding to a future beyond this life. It does not constrain us. So that is the reason why there is an inconclusiveness in death.
Actually, I heard somewhere the opposite of it. People live as if they never die and die as if they never lived.
Yeah, that's of course is another kind of sort of approach to understanding reality or life, but a kind of a deeper understanding of that first part would assume that there is a certain kind of alienation or alienness to the experience of material or physical death. There's a disjunction between the inner being and the outer being in the exterior.
Is he going to explain the the process of birth, basically how the soul takes? Are we going to cover that?
Right. Yeah, in a sense, this chapter will cover the whole philosophy of rebirth, so we'll go into it in quite great depth, this whole issue of what rebirth is and
journey of the soul and other things.
The journey of the soul, and he'll look at it philosophically. So, okay. Exactly, that's why he introduces it through this intuition, because in the whole of Life Divine, and particularly in chapters like this, he is not actually drawing so much on Shastra, but on experience. And partly it is his own experience, but also partly he is going to prod our combination of experience and intellect. How can we apply our intellect to our experience, and what is sort of justifiable in that combination? That's what he will open up through a consideration of the human being in the cosmic scheme of things.
And what is the distinction between this confidence, what we have, something like confidence he's referring to, versus the intuition? I mean, both are some kind of intuition, no?
Yeah, that's the point I was trying to make, that so-called confidence that he is, kind of laughing at to some extent, it's not really an intuition. It is also a kind of intuition, but it's more like a suggestion of the environment. It's a suggestion of the environment which belongs to a kind of universal faith. And universal faith is also formed through certain processes of history. So today, for example, atheism is a kind of rampant sort of faith. The belief of people are kind of constrained by the fact that there is a global sort of, you know, mental atmosphere which suggests the fact that there is no justification for believing in the divine or even for believing in anything that the senses don't tell us. So where did this come from? And there again, this is a very interesting thing. This is the formation of faith. Faith is formed at the individual level and also at the universal level. It is formed at the universal level through processes of history. So we find that we live today in a certain world where there is a certain kind of belief set which gives us very quickly certain types of assumptions about reality. That is common sense. And that is what he's talking about here.
Common sense can coexist with the intuition, right?
Yeah, of course it can coexist. It does coexist with the intuition, and all of common sense is not sort of, you know, erroneous, but the kind of common sense that is in a, that is making a kind of a exaggerated claim on sense experience as the datum of reality, that certainly cannot coexist. That coexists, but it ultimately has to be reconciled. You can't have both. You can't have the evidence of the senses telling you that life only appears with birth and disappears with death, and also an intuition which tells you that no, life has a pre-existence before birth and a post-existence after death. These two are contradictions. So you have to either test the other intuition, the intuition of consciousness, or you have to trust the intuition of common sense.
Thank you.
Debashista, this movement that you referred to, the 17th century, is that the Enlightenment?
Yes.
Can you tell a few words about what it really did in the plane of, in the occult planes?
Yeah, actually that question is also very well put, because that's exactly what it's all about. These historical movements do certain things in the occult plane. That's what creates universal faith. This is, Sri Aurobindo has termed it elsewhere, the suggestion of nature. So suggestion of nature may be also initiated, not maybe, is initiated by certain occult movements. But what it results in is a kind of what almost looks like a kind of a conspiracy of ideas in intellectual history. So even Western philosophers can't explain it. You see, so we have people like Hegel who have used the term Zeitgeist. Zeitgeist means time spirit, okay, spirit of time. Suddenly the Zeitgeist appears in a certain kind of way and creates a certain kind of reality. And then it moves on to another kind of reality. And this notion of Zeitgeist is present in Western philosophy throughout, you know, and even in contemporary times, people who have talked about the Enlightenment have called it an epistemic change. And by that they mean this. They mean that suddenly the way in which we knew things, the whole object and method of knowledge changed. So what happened to make it change? It's very difficult to tell, because a number of things happened. And this is why historians of the Renaissance and the Enlightenment, they write all kinds of different types of aspects of how this change occurred. But essentially, it was a change of faith. And the change of faith was from faith in a mysterious reality that, you know, only some people were privy to, in other words, initiates and people of the church, to another kind of faith in a reality that all humanity was privy to, and that was the faith in a reasonable world, a world of reason, a world that the senses could give evidence of as being reasonable. And that reasonableness itself, the rationality of the world, was its wonder. Because a rational world is very improbable. A clockwork universe is very improbable. And even more improbable is the fact that there is a species within that world that can understand the meaning of rationality. So these kind of ideas were generated in Enlightenment philosophy to cause this change of faith, you may say. And this faith is the faith of the modern world. It leads to a variety of phenomena, including colonialism. Colonialism is precluded before it comes the voyages of discovery as a movement towards knowledge, but also as a movement towards the possession of power. And so these kind of actions ultimately universalize this faith in reason, the faith in science, the faith in the rationality of the mind and of the world, of non-duality of reason. So these are the sort of basic notions that create the faith of our modern time. And in the occult world, that's what it is. So that there is a hold. You may think about it when you use the term what it causes in the occult world. You may think about it as a certain kind of tapas, a tapas of the being who keeps this time structure in its place.
What does the last part mean? The time structure in its place?
That is, so long as this age is to last, as a kind of prevailing condition of being in the universe or on earth. So that is the time structure in that sense, that the sense of being is structured through that time period by this kind of faith.
So it is obviously, if it is an occult phenomenon, it obviously spreads all over the earth sooner or later. It is not that
No, because occult phenomena may also be restricted to certain areas of time and place. But for the first time, maybe, this is a universal occult phenomenon. In other words, the whole of the earth is under its grip. Now, you may be right that there are occult phenomena, like, say, what Aurobindo is calling the symbolic age, okay, which may have applied to the whole of the earth. But still, there is an unevenness and a kind of a sort of, because they're happening separately. It's not one movement. You may say there is one kind of movement in different places. But here, it is a single movement. It's the global phenomenon of this kind of reality.
And this faith that reason is supreme is still there, right? I mean, it's possible that in here and there, like quantum mechanics.
Here and there, like quantum mechanics.
And certain related.
One could say that it is on its way out, because that is the whole notion of the Yuga Sandhya, that it has been challenged severely. Challenged by various kind of knowledge modalities right from the middle of the 19th century. And we are still in the sort of process of overcoming it. But this challenge, whatever you're talking about, let's say quantum physics or, sort of the sudden modern art or whatever other kind of modalities have challenged this primacy of sense knowledge through reason, are still under the grip of it. They haven't escaped from it. So the best that they can achieve is absurdity. If not this, then what? Then you come across the age of absurdity to some extent, an incertitude, a kind of a breaking of the sense of certainty, but an arrival at endemic doubt in its place.
Which in the big scheme might be the right way to exit from this and launch into the next faith, no?
Maybe an intermediate step.
Yeah.
See, it may be a step in that direction, and then it can be utilized. You see, there's something very interesting associated with this discussion we are just having regarding the return of truth, as it were, in the understanding of the Hindu Vishnu Puranas, where the place of Buddha is shown in these terms, that Buddha comes at a time when everything looks very rosy and perfect to seed the condition with doubt, and doubt which is so great that it opens up the possibility of a new coming of light, because people are no longer able to hold the certainty of the faith that they had in themselves anymore.
In a sense, that is the purpose of the avatar, right? To launch into a new, if not yuga, but a new way of life.
Absolutely. And if you talk about occult changes, that occult change is initiated by an avatar, and then that ultimately universalizes itself into a new kind of faith first, and then a new kind of realization.
Debashista, do you know of that these doomsday predictions from many cultures, that they have predicted towards 2012 or so, that's the end of the calendar? For example, the Mayan calendar ends at that period, and some other cultures have also predicted some sort of end. So some people think that that's the end of Kali Yuga and that's the beginning of Satya Yuga. Do you know anything of this, or it's just too vague to talk about?
Yeah, it's true, but it's interesting nevertheless that there are so many calendars that seem to be converging at this time. Of course, the kind of, skeptical, sort of view of this is also encapsulated in the term millenarianism. Millenarianism is the sort of idea that every millennium, all kinds of people kind of come together to say that something new is about to happen. That's because it's, again, intrinsic to human beings to look for changes of that kind. But it's interesting that, here we have sources which are widely different in their origin that are pointing to some point of time. Call it the age of Aquarius, call it the sort of turning of the Mayan calendar or whatever. And even you have the Enlightenment philosophers, we could very well say without putting a date on it that Hegel was looking towards this time, the end of the 20th century, as what he called the end of history. I don't want to go into it in great depth, but he had his own reasons for calling it the end of history. And we find that this convergence of ideas does happen in that case. But what I'd like to point out is that other than providing a kind of a sort of a point of interest, of curiosity, it has no real meaning for us. The only meaning it can have for us is in terms of what kind of change of consciousness is possible for us as an act of consciousness. Because these calendrical changes or astrological changes, you know, it's just dependence on some external source. Ultimately, it is only through change of consciousness that any change takes place in humanity.
Mm-hmm.
Change of faith also is really a change of consciousness.
Yeah, I think it's harder to understand what change of consciousness means than change of faith.
Yeah, true. That's why, and also not only harder to understand, it's also easier to trust in external set of sources of change.
Mm-hmm.
That the fact is that, you know, whatever external sources and our own inner conscious sort of change are interrelated in a kind of a very inseparable way, that has to be understood first. Then it is possible to see that maybe yes, but it makes no difference, because unless we make those changes, the calendar is not going to turn.
Mm-hmm.
It's like that thing about the mother saying that, you know, the supramental came down in 1956, and when it came down, she thought that everybody would be flat on the ground with the power of that descent, but nobody even knew that it had happened. So then she says that, you know, like as an occult event, it can happen, but for it to have any impact on us or make any difference to us, it may take 1,000 years.
Right, and those who predicted were mystics or people who had access to these planes.
No doubt.
Yeah.
So they are not just hypotheses.
I don't think they're hypotheses, Sita. I think all of them are based on some kind of intuition, which is what makes it interesting, because, you know, there's such a degree of convergence in these ideas. I think there is some intuition of a converging point. But people put too much, you know, sort of attention to these external predictions as if they in themselves will mean something for us. Whatever they mean for us is only in terms of our own preparation and the ability of our consciousness. I mean, you know, we have accepted Mother and Sri Aurobindo, and to us, it seems almost self-evident that the supramental has begun manifesting from 1956. But people who don't accept Sri Aurobindo and the Mother, they think those who believe in this are just a bunch of believers, you know, just a bunch of people who have taken somebody's word for truth. And it has no need of being true at all. And they're perfectly justified in thinking that, because there are no signs of such a thing. The signs have to come within, in experience.
Shall we read the next one?
Sure.
Meera, would you like to?
The first question is whether the before and the after are purely physical and vital, or in some way and more predominantly mental and spiritual. If matter were the principle of the universe, as the materialist alleges, if the truth of things were to be found in the first formula arrived at by Bhrigu, son of Varuna, when he meditated upon the eternal Brahman, matter is the eternal. For from matter all beings are born, and by matter all beings exist, and to matter all beings depart and return. Then no further questioning would be possible. The before of our bodies would be a gathering of their constituents out of various physical elements through the instrumentality of the seed and food, and under the influence perhaps of occult, but always material energies, and the before of our conscience being a preparation by heredity or by some other physically vital or physically mental operation in universal matter, specializing its action and building the individual through the bodies of our parents, through seed and gene and chromosome. The after of the body would be a dissolution into the material elements, and the after of the consciousness and the after of the conscious being a relapse into matter with some survival of the effects of its activity in the general mind and life of humanity. This life, this last quite illusory survival, would be our only chance of immortality. But since the universality of matter can no longer be held as giving any sufficient explanation of the existence of mind, and indeed matter itself can no longer be explained by matter alone, for it does not appear to be self-existent, we are thrown back from this easy and obvious solution to other hypotheses.
So here he is beginning his consideration of the basis of the appearance and disappearance of life through birth and death. What is it that is the principle, the essential constituent of this thing called life? Is it to be found in matter alone or in some material vital principle? Or as he points out here, material, vital, or mental principle, is it to be found in some kind of mental or spiritual reality? These are what he is going to consider. And the first one he takes up is this possibility that we are made up entirely and only of matter. There also, and he points to Bhrigu and his understanding of reality as material. Matter is the eternal. From matter all beings are born, and by matter all beings exist. To matter all beings depart and return. So here, and this is of course the kind of materialist sort of view that, and it is the, again we were talking about the sort of modern view, the predominant modern atheistic view of the most plausible reality for our existence having arisen purely out of matter and returning to matter, and there being no existence outside of that. But Sri Aurobindo, of course, you know, even finds that to be extremely difficult to stomach, in the sense that, you know, what are we to make of even this so-called epiphenomenon of mind and life within this life, within matter, this materialized life? And so he's pointing to the fact that, you know, I mean, even if we were to give some greater credence than just pure brute matter, we could point to the occult operation of some kind of material vital or material mental. So, because it's not difficult for us to see as mental beings and as vital beings some kind of latent vitality or mentality in matter. But if we were to come, we could very well sort of posit that there is a mentality within matter, there is a vitality within matter, but its existence begins and ends with matter. In other words, there is no pure mental being or world, nor is there any pure vital being or world. Somehow these are occult properties of matter. There is a material mental and a material vital, and these principles operate upon matter to create the conditions of consciousness which are housed by the vehicle of matter, which is the body. And that's how you can explain at least the fact of being a conscious being in an unconscious body in purely material terms. So that's what he's doing here, that he's trying to point to, you know, the possibility of being a purely material being. How would we explain it? This is how we'd explain it. And we'd say then that the birth is some kind of the before of our, he talks about both the before of our bodies and of our conscious being. And then he talks about the after of the body, which is a dissolution into the material elements, and the after of our conscious being, a relapse into matter, with some survival of the effects of its activity in the general mind and life of humanity. In other words, for a short period of time, or a temporary period of time, short or long, whatever you did in the world of human consciousness will have some mark in the memories of other people. That is that, you know, activity in the general mind and life of humanity. But this is the only kind of immortality we could hope for. You know, just as people say, you know, the writer or the author lives on and becomes immortal by his work. So this is the notion of immortality by the effects left over in general human memory of the material existence. But then he says, since the universality of matter can no longer be held as giving any sufficient explanation of the existence of mind, and indeed matter itself can no longer be explained by matter alone, for it does not appear to be self-existent, we are thrown back from this easy and obvious solution to the other hypothesis. Now, this is a very, very powerful sentence, this last sentence. Firstly, it takes us back to the fact that just individual circumstances will not explain to us the individual reality, that we have to relate it to cosmic realities. So if the individual is to be related to cosmic reality, then we have to give an explanation for this kind of matter that we are talking about, which is the birthplace and place of dissolution for material bodies as well as the consciousness of the human being. And here he's saying that if we were to do that, then we have to accept that mind has no independent existence. This is the point he's making over here, that there is some kind of physically constrained mentality. That is all we can give credence to. And that again offends our intuition. It offends our intuition because we know very well through our own experience that mind can range in its own consciousness as an independent kind of being, quite free of the material existence. And that's why, in a sense, this explanation is not a good explanation, because it does not give any explanation to the existence of mind, of the reality of a independent thing called mind, not just of some kind of locked mentality within matter. And then he says the other reason is matter itself can no longer be explained by matter alone, for it does not appear to be self-existent. That is, matter itself has got other latent properties within it which seem to be greater than all the properties of matter, and that give evidence to the formation of matter under the stress of other forms of consciousness. Again, he is drawing our attention to certain kinds of intuitions that we have at the cosmic level, even more than at the individual level.
Devashita, can you explain this part about matter not being self-existent? That means it has not been created by itself. Does that mean it?
Yeah, exactly. That is, you see, I mean, matter itself, as you know, we are saying that matter, is obedient to certain forms of order. Matter is obedient. Matter has certain properties which betray the existence of mind in matter, which betray the existence of life in matter. And in the evolution of material forms and of material consciousness, matter giving forms to consciousness, we see that, you know, the universality of these forms and of these forms of consciousness are such that matter in and by itself can't explain it. So there is a certain kind of dependence of matter. And then he's also drawing attention to the fact that our study of matter itself has shown us that matter is just a facade for something else, a representation rather than a reality.
And the last part is because they have found in science that matter is mostly air or vacuum. Is that what it is?
Yeah, and energy, that there are appearances and disappearances of particles. That matter itself cannot be given a kind of a consistent reality, an enduring reality. That plays into this, last part too. But along with it, also what plays in is the fact that the existence of the independent principle of mind in matter and arising inside matter, having the ability to operate in matter independently of matter, gives the sense of, you know, the very fact that we can study matter as a rational reality, we can look for laws in it, that it follows or obeys laws, ordered laws, means that mind is intrinsic in it. It can't be explained by itself. It can be explained in terms of mind.
So you're saying that as soon as we can find a relationship, matter to matter, and a repeatable relationship, we say that there is a higher principle in it. Let's call it mind.
Not only relationship, a law. I mean, isn't it extremely improbable that matter follows laws that are understandable by mind, that are ordered, that have a certain kind of coherence to them, that they have certain properties that are predictable? So this existence of reason within matter, that matter is ordered by a reason, is the way, only way by which we can explain matter. Science is the explanation of matter, or the description of matter in terms of mind. And ultimately, this description kind of drops to a point where it's indescribable. See, so we are left with two kinds of justifications or explanations for matter. One is that it is a kind of an extension of a certain type of reason. And the second is that it is indescribable in itself and in terms of reason. The first is the classical explanation of matter, and the second is the quantum explanation of matter.
That explains why lots of physicists who thought very deeply about matter turned into philosophers.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, the basis and the beginning of science is philosophy. And also, you know, the biggest debate in modern science is exactly this. It's the debate between Einstein and Niels Bohr, which is essentially a debate between, is the world ordered, rational, and reasonable, or is the world incomprehensible? This becomes the age-old debate of the Western world, expressing itself through science, and there is no answer to it. They are kind of locked into this debate even today.
If we were to go by this Bhrigu's tapas, which he is referring to, according to Bhrigu's tapas, it leads to Annamaya Kosha to Manomaya Kosha, right?
Pranamaya.
Annamaya, Pranamaya, Manomaya, Vijnanamaya, Anandamaya, right?
Right.
That is, mind is not refers to the Vijnanamaya Kosha, right? It should lead to the vital. From matter, it should
lead to the vital, yeah, and then to the mind.
Yes.
So here, actually, you know, the sort of he's talking about either a vital or a mental in his explanation over here. I mean, without it's. You see, the thing is about science. The thing is, they suppress. They are not aware themselves, so they suppress the fact that they are acting upon an intuition of matter being rational. Some philosophers will admit it. Philosophers of science will admit it, but most of them will not admit it. But Sri Aurobindo is drawing out the assumptions in that materialist view. And in that, there are assumptions within it, and those assumptions are that there is some kind of either life principle or mind principle acting within matter. So that's why he's talking about those occult principles of life and or mind within matter, but not independent of matter. But he ends up by pointing out that within matter, It's not some kind of a weak principle. It is the very stuff, the only way by which you can explain matter is mind. And ultimately, you can't explain it even by mind. It can't be explained by itself, and you can't even explain it by mind. It shows itself to be an incomprehensible representation by some creative faculty that we cannot understand mentally.
Debashita, can we say that the discoveries of particle physics, the fact that there is chance and there is so much vacuum, sort of gives a little credence to the Mayavadin philosophy?
Yeah, certainly. Certainly. As you know, there are people like Ulrich in Pondicherry who are explaining this entire process as what they're calling the physics of Satchidananda. It's a phrase that he has used. And according to him, the quantum formalism, as he calls it, is the physics of Satchidananda. The physics of Maya, you may say. The way by which, the kind of process by which Maya causes to appear that which doesn't have any appearance.
Is the book he's writing already published? Been hearing about it for a while.
I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
But he's been writing quite a lot. He's written a lot of articles.
Yeah, in the Skywire, right?
And he's also got a website of his own. On a related but slightly different note, Sri Aurobindo refers to this Bhrigu's tapasya on the first step of it in another context in the record of yoga. It's very interesting over there because he is evidently following this. He is practicing this himself. And you get a totally different view of this particular realization, Annam Brahma, through that reference. He's saying that, you see, the Brahma Chatushta, that is the realization of the four limbs of Brahma, the first one is Sarvam, that is, there is only, in all there is one, Sarvam. Sarvam is the universal all. So, that notion of the one in all is best served by the universality of the appearance of matter. Matter is the great leveler. Mm-hmm. From matter, everything comes, and to matter, everything disappears. Matter faces us. We can look upon it as the substance that makes everything, that gives form to everything in our material world, in our sense experience or reality. So that can be also made the first step towards the realization of Brahman as Sarvam. That becomes the way in which he proceeds to establish that, you know, by a consistent meditation on everything material all around us to be the same thing. In other words, to reduce their vital and mental properties to their material reality. There is nothing but the material reality of things around us and that material reality is the same. It is all matter. This kind of a consistent mental operation of reduction ultimately yields the realization that there is only Brahman. So that is one meditation that he follows, that he talks about in the record of yoga. And then after that is established, he moves to the second one without throwing away the first one, and that is the pranam, Brahma. And that gives him the realization of anantam. Sarvam anantam. Anantam is that in the multiplicity, because life is the principle of enduring differences, life forms. And these life forms are all different because there is a certain, you know, sort of mobilization of the infinity of the divine at play in the world. That's where it begins. So anantam is the realization of pranam Brahma. And then the third one, the realization of the principle of reason, the manomaya in matter itself, a focus on that yields jnanam. And jnanam moves into vijnanam in his realization. And then the fourth limb is anandam Brahma. So those are the four: sarvam, anantam, jnanam, anandam, Brahma, of the Brahma Chatushtaya. And they proceed through the four limbs of the four stages of Bhrigus Tapasya.
So by jnanam, it is knowing of the laws of matter, life, mind.
Yeah. In a way, we may say that science is arriving at that. It is trying to arrive at the rationality of the world, except it is arriving at it in a kind of way which is, you know, external, through the study of the laws of reality. But if it were to arrive at it intuitively, through a mental identification with the laws that are present in all things, then it would ultimately arrive at jnanam. And the word jnanam, in its highest sense, is the appearance or the realization of overmind. And beyond jnanam is vijnanam, which is the realization of supermind.
So jnanam is the realization of the divided creation, and vijnanam is the integrated, synthesized.
To some extent like that, but also divided and synthesized, but I'm talking more about the principle. So the principle of rationality, the principle of order in jnanam is a kind of law. You see, you are still on this side of the wall. In other words, it's the perfect order. You understood the meaning of order, the orderedness of the magician. On the other side, you are the creator of the order. In other words, it's not just constraint of the order, but the ability to create the order. This is very, very interesting, because it appears even in Savitri, in Ashwapati's yoga, where after understanding all these principles of harmony and tremendous sort of order, higher levels of order, he ultimately arrives at the self of mind, where everything becomes unreal to him. And then beyond that, he passes into the origin of mind, which is the supermind, that from which he can give birth to this world of, you know, miraculous order. So that is the movement from jnanam to vijnanam.
So currently at the frontiers of science, or the scientists who are mostly like theoretical scientists and not lost in individual laws, they are coming to the conclusion that the fundamental properties are things like beauty, symmetry, simplicity, and repetition of a same principle in various scales. So it's like cutting across, it's coming very close.
That is called coming to an intuition of the overmental order of all things. They are touching the hem of the overmind. They are coming to some sort of apprehension of the overmental reality.
By apprehension, do you mean something like intuition?
Like an intuition, yes.
There's another convergence in play.
Pardon?
Shall I read the next one?
Sure.
One of these is the old religious myth and dogmatic mystery of a god who creates constantly immortal souls out of his own being, or else by his breath or life power entering. It is to be presumed into material nature, or rather into the bodies he creates in it, and vivifying them internally with a spiritual principle. As a mystery of faith, this can hold and need not be examined. For the mysteries of faith are intended to be beyond question and scrutiny. But for reason and philosophy, it lacks convincingness and does not fit into the known order of things. For it involves two paradoxes which need more justification before they can even be accorded any consideration. For the hourly creation of beings who have a beginning in time but no end in time, and are moreover born by the birth of the body but do not end by death of the body. Secondly, their assumption of a ready-made mass of combined qualities, virtues, vices, capacities, defects, temperamental and other advantages and handicaps, not made by them at all through growth, but made for them by arbitrary fiat, if not by law of heredity, yet for which and for the perfect use of which they are held responsible by their creator.
Thank you.
here he is moving into the vital creation, and he's talking about explaining material existence and material life by a principle outside of matter. That's why, as he says, that material existence is not self-sufficient, can't be explained by itself. So what can it be explained by? So the life appearing in matter has one kind of explanation in a creator God who, as it were, blows life into matter. In other words, he brings together certain formations. This is not some daemons inside matter, but an external God, some supreme being who's using matter as a kind of plastic substance to create a form and then blow life into it out of his own breath, like a vital breath, and then put this out to exist. Now, this kind of a life form is, as he points out, problematic in two ways. One is, therefore, it has a point of time as its beginning, a material beginning and a spiritual beginning, a consciousness beginning in consciousness. But from that point of time, it exists forever. It may drop its body, but that breath has to continue. So it has an existence which has a beginning but no determinable end. And then the other problem over there is that, so that particular beginning and no end corresponds to the more sort of material reality of it, the creation of beings. And then there is the quality of consciousness of this particular being. So just as its existence is a kind of a sudden and abrupt existence with a beginning but no determinable end, so too the quality of consciousness is an arbitrary combination of forces, of qualities, of psychological qualities, attributes, without any kind of development, as it were. What determines this beginning? There is no seed state. It's similar to the notion of the creationist myth, where God made Adam and Eve out of his, own stuff, and planted them on the earth out of material stuff and blew life into that material thing. So they had a beginning. But what gave the characteristics of that beginning? From where was that to arise? So this is basically this kind of creationist, abrupt, miracle or miraculous sort of appearance of qualities that he's talking about as an explanation for material appearance of life in any individual form, or even in a cosmic form, in other words, a typal form. But you see, the problem over here is that it can be acceptable if we don't want to find any philosophical cogency for it. But otherwise, again, here he's showing us the opposite, that it offends our intuition because it doesn't seem to hold that kind of, explanation for why things have growth inbuilt into them. How come it is that seems to be some sort of a law of growth in the world, in consciousness and in form? What is it that this law of growth consists of? Why is it that our constitution of consciousness is different? Is it just random? Is it just started with some kind of random combination of forces? Or is there a law to it of some kind? If there is a beginning, has it got something which starts from a more invisible seed state than a middle state that is suddenly full blown, just made to appear by some magic of God. So what he's getting at here again is the presence of law, the presence of idea. And ultimately, idea comes from real idea, which is vijnana or supermind. That's what he's getting at. He's getting from the impossibility of explaining the presence of spirit in material individualized form by matter itself to the impossibility of explaining the presence of life forms in matter by the principle of life itself to what alone can explain it, the presence of law and order and the creation of a mystery which has a certain meaning to it, of the self conception and self exploration and play of the one.
Because it is God who is blowing life power, why is the mystery not possible? It is possible, no? That could be a valid explanation, right?
Yeah, of course it could be a valid explanation, and there could be worlds of this kind too. What he's sort of challenging, or what he's finding implausible in it, is again based on the nature of this world. In other words, the fact that there is a growth that we can see all around us, and that there are principles of you know, law to that process of growth. That's the reason why this notion of something that is blown life into in the middle point, whether it is possible or not, is not plausible in this universe. That's why you see, right in the beginning, he has that, quotation from the Gita. If you remember, the whole chapter begins with that quotation from the Gita, of which the last line is, certain is the death of that which is born, and certain is the birth of that which dies.
Right.
That's of course he's pointing there, but I mean, he's pointing to that because it's just like the mystery of the seed and the tree, that there is a certain kind of circularity to appearance and disappearance, that it can't come full blown in the middle. It has to start from a beginning, or the appearance of a beginning, and end with the appearance of an end, but these appearances have beginnings before them and ends after them. You cannot start from the middle, in other words. That starting from the middle offends the philosophical paradox of the eternal who is being born in time. The eternal being born in time cannot have any true beginning. It has to have a true interminable beginning, and it cannot have any true end. It has to have an interminable end. And that's the reason why this notion of suddenly coming full-blown into a beginning doesn't obey the form of this universe. The idea, the cosmic idea, that is at work in all things here. Now, of course, as you're saying, God could do anything so that such a reality is possible, but it would be a freak reality. Or it would be a law in some other world or universe.
So Darwinism, you're saying, is more rational than creationism because life started really small and perhaps it's going to end also one day really small, whereas creationism started at the apex.
Yeah, not merely being, yeah, of course it is a, you know, again it connects with systems theory, as you were pointing out, in the fact that our life's evolution is related to an even earlier evolution, the evolution of the universe as a material reality through the Big Bang and the expansions and contractions of, of whatever there is prior to matter. But when we find, any beginning, it is, in the Darwinian evolutionary sense, it is preceded by some beginning that goes before it. In that sense, it is much more reasonable. Because species appear, they carry the sort of, impress of the history of the evolution of consciousness. In his case, of course, just the evolution of life, but and forms, life forms. But nevertheless, it carries that kind of sense of a memory or the sense of a growth or of a struggle of life forms, which can always be traced back earlier than earlier in time and doesn't come full blown at any point.
Though some people could challenge this very fact that why should we follow reason? I mean, what is the logic for us following a system that is more reasonable than something that is more not reasonable or more based on faith?
Yeah, but the fact is that even if you are going to prioritize faith, we have to either say that, following the mystic trajectory, we don't want to, consider the existence of any idea because everything is an act of God. That's a kind of a choice, and it's a valid choice, but that does not abrogate the fact that there is all around us the operation of some kind of idea. Ideas in the world. Now, that operation and the presence of mind in us is what gives justification to the whole enterprise of philosophy to try and come up with rational understandings of the universe. And that's why Sri Aurobindo is going through this. The only way place differs is to say that it is beyond the mind that reason is to be found. Not that there is no reason to be found, but the quality of that reason, it's a difference in kind, not in degree. There is an idea, and he is going to point to what is that idea. That idea is the supramental idea. But that idea is at work everywhere in the universe, which is why we see it and understand it through our minds. We understand the distortion of it, or only a partial reality of it, through the mind. That's why the manomaya is a kind of an approach towards the vijnanamaya. Jnana is an approach to vijnana. But nevertheless, it cannot be denied that it exists. We can deny it, but that denial is only an individual choice. It doesn't change the reality of the existence of the idea all around us and in us.
for these discussions, at a certain point, you have to draw the line that this is my experience, and perhaps when you progress or the opponent progresses, he will be able to experience it. Before that, all this discussion is redundant.
Yeah, of course. To a certain extent, yes. I mean, it is all based on experience, reasoning, and intuition. All three of these are involved in these discussions. And, you know, there is a point beyond which it makes no sense to any particular person's experience, that it is constrained by the state of experience and the state beyond which there isn't, you know, one cannot move, because one has to meditate on it and experience it. But still, what he's doing is he's trying to constantly push our boundaries of consideration. He's making us change our habits of knowledge so that we can open ourselves to other ways of knowing the cosmos and our place in it.
Yes, very beautiful. I think we can read one more paragraph.
Okay, let's read one more.
Jyoti, do you want to read?
I'm actually eating, is that okay?
Yeah, not a problem. Yeah. Vince, do you want to read? Oh, yeah, I could read. Am I reading?
Yeah, you can read.
Yeah.
Why don't you read?
Yeah. We may maintain, provisionally at least, certain things as legitimate presumptions of the philosophic reason, and fairly throw the burden of disproving them on their denier. Among these postulates is the principle that that which has no end must necessarily have had no beginning. All that begins or is created has an end by cessation of the process that created and maintains it, or the dissolution of the materials of which it is compounded, or the end of the function for which it came into being. If there is an exception to this law, it must be by a descent of spirit into matter, animating matter with divinity, or giving matter its own immortality. But the spirit itself, which so descends, is immortal, not made or created. If the soul was created to animate the body, if it depended on the body for its coming into existence, it can have no reason or basis for existence after the disappearance of the body. It is naturally to be supposed that the breath or power given for the animation of the body would return at its final dissolution to its maker. If, on the contrary, it still persists as an immortal embodied being, there must be a subtle or psychic body in which it continues, and it is fairly certain that this psychic body and its inhabitant must be pre-existent to the material vehicle. It is irrational to suppose that they were created originally to inhabit that brief and perishable form. An immortal being cannot be the outcome of so ephemeral an incident in creation. If the soul remains but in a disembodied condition, then it can have had no original dependence on a body for its existence. It must have subsisted as an unembodied spirit before birth, even as it persists in its disembodied spiritual entity after birth.
We can, I think, return to that paragraph next time. But you can already see how Sri Aurobindo is almost pushing our reason and intuition, the combination of the two, to accede to the eternal existence of the psychic being and its appearance on the roads of matter, on the roads of time and space, as a kind of, you know, sort of eternal succession, a succession without beginning or end. That it could not have appeared due to the, you know, sort of formation of a material body. The material body was taken by it. It was assumed by it. But it existed before and after that material body. So this is essentially what he's going to get to in this particular paragraph, and how he's going to connect it to what went before, and you know, the fact that the life principle could not have appeared out of nowhere by the breath of God, as it were, and just enlivened matter for the existence within a certain material form.
Hi Keka, are you in India?
Sorry, my microphone was muted. I am in Tanicherry.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's actually about 7:30 our time now, 2 hours before this time actually.
Yeah, I know. It's just that, you know, some people came, so I wanted to join, but I couldn't. So that's how. Yeah, sorry about that. Continue, please.
Yes, we are almost done, and we are closing actually.
Okay.
Yeah, let's end with a brief meditation.